Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Runner's World podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you the latest training advice, news and interviews from the wide world of running. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, tell us what we've got coming up on this episode.
This month's podcast is themed around the environment, and our very own Jay Maguire is coming in to discuss how running can clean up its act. Keith Foley, race director of the Harrow Half Marathon, talks about why he decided to do away with plastic at this year's race. Journalist Isaac Williams is joining to talk about plogging, and Kerry McCarthy takes a look at the ethical running gear.
Runner's World Podcast.
Plastic bottles have long been a fixture of large running races. The same goes for plastic goodie bags and energy gels. But with an increasing number of people making the case against single-use plastics, it's time for races and running brands to find more environmentally friendly alternatives. RW's deputy digital editor Jay Maguire has been doing some investigating and is with us now. Jane, what have you found out?
Hello. I have been doing some research into kind of the problem, and some horrible kind of stats to start with are that 300 million tonnes of plastic are made each year. And 50% of that is like single use, like plastic bottles, things you can't use again. And by 2050, there'll be more plastic in the sea than fish. Kind of, I think something has to change. And I've been talking to OHO, and they've made those little pouches that we've probably all maybe heard of, maybe not heard of.
Okay, so what is OHO then?
So it's like a little pocket of water that you can eat.
Right.
And it's made from seaweed.
Yeah.
And they've kind of, I think they're quite a new company, and they've spent like 4 years looking into the problem.
So it's just an edible water pocket.
Yeah, so you can treat it like a gel and kind of bite it, rip it, take the water out, throw that little thing on the floor because it will biodegrade in 4 weeks or something.
Right.
But you can just run along and eat it.
Okay.
I haven't tried one, so I can't.
But
I don't know how that would feel.
Have they been used at races?
Yeah, they've been. I think they've been a few. I think they're used at Harrow.
Harrow Half, yeah.
Okay.
And I think they've been used at a few different races. And I think they're kind of. They said to me, oh, we're trying to get bigger.
So say this takes off, and then you've got the problem of like manufacturing for a major. And how you produce enough seaweed pockets for 50,000 people.
Sure. Yeah.
How much seaweed do you need?
Yeah, that's a good practical question. Yeah.
I asked them about kind of bigger events.
Yeah.
Obviously, things like London Marathon, how would you make that greener? You couldn't have like a big water thing and ask people to carry their own, but it would be carnage. Like, there's just too many people.
For sure. Yeah.
And equally, you wouldn't want to take water away and not have runners dehydrating. That would, you know, be a nightmare.
Absolutely.
And they said they're working because they've obviously only got quite a short shelf life before they start breaking down.
Right.
So they're working on a machine that can kind of mass produce them, and the London Marathon would be like a dream.
Yeah.
But obviously they're doing kind of smaller races to get it right and get the amount of pods or pouches or the size of the pouch right before you kind of think big, I guess.
Okay, yeah. Can I ask an obvious question? Why is single-use plastic such a bad thing? Why should we be moving away from that?
The biggest problem, I think, is that only 9%, I'm getting these from the internet, so I might be wrong.
Yeah, sure.
It might be more, it might be less. 9% of the plastic is recycled, and it's not just people can't be bothered, it's that it can't be.
Yeah.
And I think even though I think this year especially, people are suddenly, everyone's talking about it, and they've banned straws, and, you know, more and more people are carrying reusable bottles and stuff. But I think it's kind of, the plastic ends up in the oceans, and it's harming everything.
Fish life and all that
stuff. Everything. Yeah. And you've got, like, you know, David Attenborough, and everyone's kind of coming out and being like, we need to stop using plastic. And I think it's not just the organisers. I think it's the runners have to be more responsible. Mm. Like, we saw on Twitter, didn't we, that picture of all the gel packets that someone had found in on a trail run. And I think it's not hard to put it in your pocket and take it home, but we're probably all to blame. Like, we probably all dropped the little cap at one point.
Sure.
Because when you're running, it's not on the top of your mind, is it? So I think there was something on Twitter this week about Bournemouth Marathon and the amount of plastic in the goodie bags and how that was left not on the beaches but around that area. And it's kind of like, well, you can't blame the it's the runners that have left it behind.
Yeah,
you don't want to. If that was you,
the organisers aren't littering their
own event. They're not going out there and throwing bottles into the sea.
Yeah.
They're trying to put on an event, so it is hard. But there has to be a kind of balance, I guess.
Absolutely, there's an element of personal responsibility, isn't there?
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to litter, that's actually your individual fault.
Yeah.
Whereas using plastic is a bit of a bigger thing, actually. It's more of an organisational decision, I guess. Other than banning plastic bottles and using OHO or a similar solution, how else could running clean up its act?
We were talking yesterday about the reusable gel packets.
Yeah.
And, you know, could you... Or is there a way of recycling gel packets?
Well,
I'm not sure.
I've used new... So if you, when you buy, like, toddler... like, well, baby food,
yeah,
those little pouch things, you can buy resealable ones of those.
Okay.
So, like, we're talking not just gel size but bigger volume.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you can, I've run with those and just blended up a thing and just put it in there for as a carry sake.
Yeah,
I mean, but it is more cumbersome because there's a lid on it, like a screw top,
right? Okay.
Thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's not like this is, you know, handy. It's like you've got to have a little bag on and stuff like that.
But that's the thing, isn't it? That's
convenience.
It's the convenience of the plastic bottle, isn't it? Like, that's why it's appealing, I think, to race organisers, that there's an amount that people can unscrew lid and you see how much you're drinking, you get a lot of water. It doesn't slow people down. I think that's another thing, isn't it? Where, like, the London Marathon, a lot of people, it's about PB. So it's like, if I'm losing a second or 5 seconds at water station, for a lot of runners, that's going to feel like intolerable. Like, oh my God, like, I'm only just going to go under 3:30, and if I have to start, you know, using the communal trough to get water,
exactly,
that's gonna dig into
what about double dipping in the communal.
I think even like I did Kew Gardens the other week, and they had kind of, I think they were compostable cups.
Right, okay, right.
So the idea is that they're easier to recycle and they're better for the environment, but they're actually really hard to, it's hard to drink from a cup when you're you're moving.
Yeah,
you don't want to stop, and you don't want to kind of even slow down enough to kind of have a leisurely drink. And I know there is a kind of knack of folding them. A pinch technique that I just haven't got down.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, you end up pouring it all down your front, and that's fine, you know, whatever. You never look good in a race photo, but I don't know if I've had enough water.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's kind of like, oh, you know, I want to save the world, but I kind of want a drink. and it's like, what do you do?
Yeah, yeah.
And I walked away from that thinking, oh gosh, I've always been like, no, there shouldn't be plastic bottles. But actually, it was really hard to drink from a cup. So it's kind of, I think, I don't know. It's really hard to get that balance, I guess.
Yeah, maybe we're yet to find the ideal solution.
Yeah.
Do you think you would enter a race? I mean, and this would require a company to sort of take this on, but if it was a totally green race and that was the remit of it, so all the money that they would spend on plastic goodie bags, and there's no goodie bag, like, that's their premise, is there's zero plastic involved in this. So you go along and it might cost maybe the same or a bit more to enter, but you're going in knowing ethically that you've entered a race that provides no plastic and that there's a drink solution, whatever it is, that you can, you know, I think
there would be an appetite for that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think goodie bags are great, for sure, but, like, at the end of the day, if it was like, here's another bag of random popped, like, popcorn that's burnt with chia seeds, you know, you get that sort of food that kind of no one wants.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
sorts of things. Like, I'm fine without that.
I know, like, Royal Parks are doing tote bags now.
Okay.
And obviously you pay quite a lot to run the Royal Parks.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I know
yeah.
that's their solution, that you don't have, you have like a cool tote bag that you can use again in the shops, you know, not take a plastic bag to the shop. So, and I think they've banned gels. You have, or they're not giving out gels.
Yeah. They also have a wooden medal.
Yeah, and a wooden medal.
Nice.
So they're trying to be really green. I think London Marathon has said they What did they do? They did cups at some stations. Yeah. I didn't do it last year, this
right.
year.
Yeah.
What else did they say? Apparently they did a big campaign about trying to get you to empty your bottle.
Yeah, there was that. You squeeze
it. So it's easier to recycle because they can just sweep them up. Yeah. And I think they are aware, but I think, yeah, London Marathon is a big
beast. I mean, major. any major, I think, is going to be a huge undertaking.
That's the issue, isn't it? Like, you can say that smaller races, like swim runs or even like ultra marathons, where it's maybe for most people not about kind of time and stuff. But I think it's seemingly a little impractical at the minute for big city races to completely do away with plastic bottles. Or I just don't, unless this OHO solution is actually easily scalable and everyone's comfortable with it, I think there's some work to be done to find a satisfactory
Someone please
solution.
Find the solution.
Yeah.
Well, then OHO is saying it's just they're still looking for sponsors and they're kind of quite new.
Right.
So imagine they are, they're trying to save the world, but they're quite small at the moment.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it is just, the things that I guess you have to, with water and it's not like it's, we're going to try and design like medals without plastic on. It's kind of really important, isn't
it?
And you'd only need one awful headline where someone, didn't get enough water for it to just be a nightmare. So I guess you have to be really careful. But yeah, I do think it is down to runners too, which, I think is always hard.
Did you get a sense through looking into this that, like, this is the way the wind's blowing and actually in a couple of years' time, the idea of, like, the plastic bottle was going to seem quite dated?
I think, I really do. I do think so. Because I think every time, even when I asked runners to get in touch if they'd done Harrow Half, which was plastic-free, and it was all very positive. There was no one, saying, I was really thirsty, I wish I had a plastic bottle, which is kind of what I just said about you, which is awful. It was great. But, there wasn't any kind of... I think everyone is suddenly really keen, and I think there is a lot of kind of, we're all being made very aware what we're doing to the planet at the moment.
Yeah.
So I think, I don't think you often, I hadn't really thought about it at running events until I saw a video, I can't remember where I saw it last year, of them sweeping up the bottles at the end of the marathon, and you think, whoa, like that's, you don't think about it when you're doing the race. You just throw your bottle on the floor because you've got 20 miles to go.
Yeah. Oh, undoubtedly, yeah. No, it's interesting. I wonder if we'll look back at sort of 2018 as a sort of tipping point with a lot of this stuff, actually.
Well, the fact that there's now like a usable product. Because for years it must have been speculatory. Like, maybe we could do this. But actually, someone's found a legit solution to it. All that needs to happen is actually it's a production thing.
Yeah.
It's a financial and a manufacturing issue rather than an idea issue.
Yes, that's true.
So that always makes it, I think, and a slightly brighter future.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Well, Jay, thanks very much for coming on the Runners World podcast. I think we're going to invite you back next month. We'll be talking about nutrition and stuff. But it was great to hear a bit more about the plastic problem and the kind of companies that are trying to find solutions.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
No worries.
Thanks. Cheers.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
For more from Runners World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
Get ready to be disappointed, Rick.
Okay.
As 4-foot strikers, this is bad news for us.
Okay.
The heel strike is back.
Right.
I mean, it didn't go away, but...
Sure.
It's returned from its pit of shunned running nonsense. A new study revealed that at last year's World Track and Field Champs in London, of the 70 elite runners analysed during the men's marathon, 67% landed on their heels.
Wow.
30% landed on their midfoot and 3% landed on their forefoot.
Only three.
Only three.
Yeah.
The percentages were similar to in the women's marathon, with 73% heel striking, 19% midfoot and 3% forefoot.
There you go. Well, I'm throwing away my V-Brown five fingers as we speak.
Good.
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because, obviously the kind of the whole anti-heel strike thing that was around a few years ago, I think encouraged lots of runners to run in an unskilled way, forefoot running. It's not like the magic bullet of like, I'm forefoot running now, therefore I'm going to be injury free and I'm running well.
I saw a really interesting picture that went alongside, not perhaps this study, but of something similar, which was showed every single elite and their foot position upon strike.
Yeah.
And it was obviously done like start of the race, end of the race.
Mm.
And so obviously let's take into a fact that at the start of the race, everyone's form is fantastic and they're all feeling great, and by the end they're all knackered. So, but very similar, exactly that. Lots and lots of like very, people think heel strike and they think some sort of like
huge, resounding impacts, leg shattering, femur destroying. Like, but it's not. It's still a very smooth transition. Yeah. But it's just that heel is for 200th of a millisecond, the first bit of foot that touches the floor.
Sure.
So that's a heel strike.
Yeah.
So I mean, it kind of makes sense, but I think it's something that probably, you're right, people do think, like, I must be on my forefoot.
You're right, there's such thing as a skilled heel strike, isn't there?
For sure.
And it's almost like a kind of heel touch, I guess. The term strike is like you say,
It makes it feel like a really aggressive, aggressive blow.
Exactly.
But no, this is more of a, like, you know, a whole foot absorption thing.
And it's more about where your foot is in relation to your centre of mass, isn't it? Rather than actually what part of the foot is touching first.
I would absolutely go out on a limb and say that none of these elites are heel striking ahead of their centre of mass.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
They're not putting that. They're not breaking to, you know, exactly. They're landing underneath themselves yet heel striking.
Yeah.
Runner's World Podcast.
This year, the Harrow Half Marathon made the brave and bold decision to ban plastic bottles and cups at its aid station, becoming the first major UK road race to do so. Instead of plastic bottles, runners use biodegradable water sachets made from seaweed. We're delighted to be joined by Keith Foley, the race director, to find out why he wanted the event to be plastic-free. So, Keith, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
How did you come to the decision to ban single-use plastic at the race?
Long story, I guess, but no one can have watched Blue Planet without starting to think about, you know, what are we doing? And actually, the real honest truth is it was an initial conversation between myself and our local MP, actually, who's been a big supporter of our race since we started it just last year. And he had a contact in Selfridges who actually sponsored us to do this because they have a big environmental program at the store. And actually, it just, you know, the ball started rolling very, very quickly about the idea of doing something that would remove single-use plastic from, certainly on the course. We thought about doing it for literally everything to start with, but you start realising things like the nylon zip ties and things for your signage. How do you remove those in short order? There's going to be a solution, but we haven't got to that yet. But yeah, so it was a discussion literally just around some of us who organised the race.
How successful was your new solution? Did you have targets that you wanted to meet, or was it just sort of a trial and error kind of process?
It was incredibly successful, actually. I mean, that evening, I have to say, after the race, I was on Twitter a lot seeing what the feedback was, and I didn't see a single negative feedback. We received quite a lot of information through our, email from runners saying it was really good. And there was quite a lot of stories beforehand. Both BBC and ITV London News has picked it up as a big positive story. We got a lot of really positive feedback about the concept. As to success, huge success, I would say. There's definitely some feedback for the manufacturers about, you know, some of the experience we had. We ran out. So we had three water stations on the course, which you passed each one twice. Right. And we did run out at two of them, which was a concern at early doors, because normally you've just got big bowsers of water and you know, running out of water isn't going to be an issue. But actually, because these are a finite number you've had delivered to the water stations, trying to work out how many you needed was actually quite difficult.
I was going to say, was this a sort of a balance between not necessarily not having enough, but more people unsure that how many they needed?
Yeah, and actually there is a knack to using these particular products.
Right, yeah.
So we had some at the race HQ for people to play with at the start, and if you'd have been there, you'd have seen people, you know, bursting them, because if you squeeze them, which you would do with a gel, say, they burst.
Right.
And you just get a wet hand. You actually just need to sort of bite the corner and suck the water out.
Right.
So it's a technique. So people were, you know, basic feedback I got from people on the day was, I messed the first couple up, but actually it was really easy once you got the hang of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, there's a sort of a wastage, I guess, that we haven't accounted for.
Are they easy to grab, like, at top speed on the move?
At the water stations, people are holding them out for you to take, in the same way that you would hold out a bottle.
Sure.
So you can grab them on the run. Different techniques for different speed of people.
Yeah.
The feedback from the water stations was actually for the slower runners, it was actually easier to drop it into their palm. For the faster runners, they were grabbing them as they were running past.
I think it's a really brave decision to do it. Was there some kind of trepidation? Because I guess as a race director, one of your key things would be runner safety.
Yes.
Were you worried about actually, like, trialling this?
Yeah, two things, I think. One, we were nervous about, you know, is there a taste? Are people going to literally take the water and go, yeah, that's horrible. Mm. Yeah, I mean, seaweed.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a salty water product that you're drinking? So there was a lot of concern amongst us until we actually managed to get some samples ourselves to try out. And there is no taste. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So we were a little bit worried about that. I think the second thing was we genuinely were worried about whether we'd run out or not, you know, and those fears were realised. But we did have a backup in place, so we actually ordered several thousand biodegradable cups.
Yeah.
So, and we had some normal reusable water bowsers at each station as a backup. So we were able to give sort of the later runners effectively cups of water. But these are cups that you can just chuck in your food waste and will decompost.
Oh, great!
So that was our backup. Because we knew we couldn't go with a plastic alternative because we really didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So those were our two key concerns.
And so, minus the biodegradable cups, what's cleanup like?
Well, the biodegradable cups was relatively easy because we didn't actually need that many of them. So that was okay. And cleanup. So the actual what you're left with, if you imagine you're making a jelly and you've got the sheets of gelatin. And you put it in the hot water and obviously they dissolve. But that point before they've dissolved, but when they've become soft, if you pick it out, it's just a bit floppy, isn't it?
You're
left with something that's a bit like that when you finish using it. But within 2 hours, it's completely dried out. It's like an autumn leaf on the side of, you know, on the side of the road. And I think it's something like within 3 or 4 weeks, it's completely degraded. It's gone. So at the actual water stations themselves, we did stiff broom and just brush a few of them together and just pick them up and chuck them in the bin type thing. But on the whole, where the water stations were, they were in park areas or near grassland.
Right.
So actually them going onto those areas, and I did actually go for a run along there myself the next day. And actually you couldn't even see them because they're clear. So even if you throw them on the grass, you know, they don't leave an unsightly you know, mess along the side of the road.
That's great. And the council, you said you've worked with the MP, so they must be, I mean, they were very happy with the fact that that's the aftermath.
Yeah. I mean, I've got to say, you know, we work with Active Training World as well, who run a lot of events all across the country.
Yeah.
And James, who runs them, is constantly amazed at the support we get from the council, actually. They're really good. So we do, of course, have lots of litter at the end, particularly from Race HQ. We tend to bundle that up and leave it on the road, and they send a van up and clear it all up the next day.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they love the fact that they didn't have to go out onto the course picking up litter.
Yeah.
Yeah, definite big bonus. And
I mean,
that working relationship with a local authority for any race organiser is really, really important.
Is there a cost implication to using it? It was OHO that you used, right?
UHO,
UHO.
UHO.
UHO. Is it more expensive to use them than it is plastic bottles currently, or is it similar?
So for us, actually, there was no cost implication because we were lucky enough that Selfridges actually covered the bill for this.
Right.
And actually, previously, we've had support from other local companies. So last year, we had support from Tesco's to do the water on the course.
Okay.
You know, they delivered bottled water for us last year. So actually, we've never actually seen a cost to the water, which is great. And we have Affinity Water as one of our local sponsors as well. So actually, at the race finish, which is another one of our concerns, was what do you give people when they finish? Because when you cross the finish line, you do need a drink straight away, don't you?
Yeah.
So actually, we gave them cycling bottles, you know, the sort of 750ml cycling bottles full of water. So that was, you know, a takeaway reusable that you could use. So actually, we're very lucky that we've got support from lots of local companies, and we've never seen a cost to that.
Okay,
but I think that the cost from talking to the.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Producer of this, it is more expensive than buying bottled water. But the cost was less than I was thinking. I won't give you a number because we haven't had to pay for it. I'm not actually sure.
But you don't get the sense that it's prohibitively expensive.
No, absolutely not. No, and I know other races have used these.
Yeah.
Chippenham Half had one water station using these as well. So yeah, other race organisers have got involved. And actually, the day after our race, James at Active Training World took a call from three different race organisers asking how we'd got involved with this, and I've had a number of emails from other race organisers asking how did it go, we're thinking of doing this as well. So,
well, that was going to be my next question really. Do you think that this is that you're going to be at the forefront of change here, and actually lots of other races are going to start following suit?
I think just that contact we were getting afterwards shows that people are definitely thinking that way. I mean, I think we did a wash up earlier this week actually with the council, and actually as we were all sat around the table that evening, we were like, we're going to look back at this and just we're going to be completely bemused by the fact that we used to take a plastic bottle and throw it on the floor. You know, in 5 years, 10 years, however long it's going to be, we are going to look back at this and just think, what were we doing?
Yeah, I think so.
And so say the water solution is fixed, what's the next, as a race organizer, what's the next big thing that's like waste heavy that needs to get sorted with races?
So I would challenge that the water's fixed, actually, because I think there is a production limitation on this product. I think it's a bit like any new technology, actually. We're almost an early adopter.
Yes.
And I'm not sure this will actually be the final solution, because there were some issues with it. I mean, these things, I think after about 4 or 5 days, they dissolve. And there was a percentage, probably 10 to 20% of the ones that we had delivered weren't really usable. So there is, you know, there's a production issue. You know, I think these guys are totally on top of it, and you know, they're breaking ground really with this stuff.
Yeah.
So there will be some changes, I think, you know, and who knows what else is to come in this industry. So I don't think it's quite solved.
Yeah.
But I think we're well on the path to doing it. But I think, you know, if you imagine London Marathon, say, you know, with just the volume that they need to produce and supply.
Yeah,
I think that would be a challenge at this point in time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't envisage that in 5 years' time there won't be some solution for a big event like that. We're already sat there going, what do we do next year?
Yeah, actually, because
that was quite a big step. And we know absolutely we can't go back to using bottled water next year.
Yeah,
it's just a complete no-go. So even if we weren't able to get a sponsor to cover that, we would be using some form of non single-use plastic.
So you're committed to that going forward then?
I think we have to be. I just don't think there's a going back now.
Yeah. When is the race next year? Have you got a date set?
September the 15th.
September the 15th. Going plastic free again.
Absolutely.
Sounds good. Well, Keith, thanks so much for coming on. It was really interesting.
That's really, I mean, I do really hope that what you guys have done and have started kind of trickles down. Water joke. awful. I hope that is adopted by many. I think it's definitely something that needs to change.
Yeah. Thanks, Kiki. Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Cool.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
We've received a lovely letter from a reader. Jamie Campbell writes, from a mistaken belief as a young man that life got better as you got older, like an upward line on a graph, I soon found out that ups and downs of life were part of a natural cycle. One thing that remained consistent for me, however, was my running and what it gave back to me. I hope someone, like I did many years ago, picks up your magazine and reads how running can become as faithful a friend as a trusted collie dog. In times of increasing awareness about personal well-being, if one person reads this and starts a journey of discovery on the benefits of running, then that's a welcome start.
That's great, isn't it? That's one of the nicest things about the jobs, is receiving these emails from readers about the many and varied ways that running has improved their lives.
Yeah, I think starting doing this podcast actually has really helped sort of like enlighten me in terms of the different ways that running has helped people. Just everyone, I got into running for whatever reasons, and so you for whatever else. But then, you know, the variety of stuff that happens in people's lives, and they seek solace in a bit of outdoor sweatiness.
No, it's true, mate. And I think when Paul Tonkinson came on the show, he described, you know, running can be like your best mate. And I think that's a recurring message that we get. Actually, running can feel like a friend that's there for you, and that friendship can change, you know, throughout your life. But it's that kind of constant thing that you can depend upon, which is great.
So thanks, Jamie.
If you've got a similar running story, don't be shy, let us know. podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
Runner's World Podcast.
Another way in which runners are cleaning up their act is through plogging, the noble art of running while picking up litter. Health and fitness journalist Isaac Williams wrote a piece on plogging in a recent issue of Runner's World, and he's now here to tell us about the craze that's sweeping the streets. Hi, Isaac, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. You recently went plogging. Can you give us a quick overview of what it's all about?
Yeah, so plogging is, I guess, the marriage of kind of running and litter picking. And it's really kind of as simple as that. So you go for a run, you take a litter picker and a bin bag with you, and you kind of clean the streets as you go.
Nice. It's quite a weird word, plogging. Have you got any idea where it's sort of the derivation of it?
Yeah, I think it's kind of literally a combination of jogging and picking up.
Right.
So those two words combined. And yeah, it kind of originated in Sweden.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, I think. Well, I guess people have been running and picking up litter since people started
since
running,
time
right?
Began. Since some conscientious person went, that's not right.
It's not a kind of wildly new concept. I think what is new about plogging is the fact that it's kind of a defined movement, and people meet up in groups and go out to try and kind of clean up their local areas.
So what is it like to go plogging? I mean, Is it a time to base a structured training plan around your plogging event?
No, I think that's probably the first thing to say. Yeah, it's best to reserve your plog for your kind of long, slow run.
Yeah.
I've read a few articles saying, oh yeah, it's a great kind of upper body workout because you're bending out. I think that might be stretching it a little bit. But there's no reason it can't be incorporated into kind of a long, slow run. I think that works that way. But yeah, as for how it is, I think it's great. You've kind of, the first time... When I made my kind of my plogging debut a few months ago, it was with a group called After Ploggers, which was based in kind of central London, set up by a headphone brand Aftershocks.
Yeah.
About 10 of us met in Regent's Park, central London, which is admittedly probably one of the most pristine, well-kept, litter-free areas of of the country. But even so, it was kind of quite shocking, actually, the amount of litter you see en route. Once you've been running for sort of 5 minutes, your kind of plogging senses are honed, and you start to see like every cigarette butt, every bottle cap. It's kind of quite shocking, the amount, just this kind of sheer quantity of litter that there is. Yeah.
Is that one of the things that you sort of, once you've switched your brain to looking for it?
Yeah, 100%, definitely. Like I say, after the first 5 minutes, you're like, oh, this is, we're not going to get anything. Yeah. But then, yeah, within kind of 10 minutes, our bags were kind of beginning to bulge with all sorts.
Apart from eagle eye and a bin bag, what else does one need to go plogging?
Yeah, so just kind of standard running kit. I think gloves are probably advisable. A litter picker, that's essential.
Okay.
And a kind of heavy duty bin bag. You don't want to be scrimping on your bin bag. You want some...
Do you double bag?
I didn't double bag. No, I think if you go for quality, then you shouldn't need to.
You want volume though. You want literage. You want like a good 70 litres.
Yeah, you want a big one.
Yeah.
Is 70 litres?
I've plucked a number from the air.
It's like, sounds massive.
Think backpacks.
Yeah.
Right? So your average commute bag.
Don't bring your backpacks.
You know, but I'm saying an average run pack would be 12 litres.
backpack and bin bag, maybe. Yeah. Oh.
So if you think a bag is normally like 20 litres,
yeah.
70, big bag.
Yeah.
Yeah, go for
Fair play. Fair play.
Are there any... So you've mentioned the after pickers, after ploggers.
After ploggers,
you mentioned
yeah.
the after ploggers. Do you know of any other official groups that people can join?
So I think the kind of beauty of it is it's kind of sweeping the nation. So I think most local running clubs now are kind of taking plogging on board and are kind of adopting it into their kind of weekly schedules. So yeah, I think in terms of kind of finding out one near you, I think just go to your local running club, or there's also a kind of Twitter handle at PloggingGB, I think it is, which kind of has all the kind of up-to-date plogging news.
Since your plogging experience, are you more likely to pick up litter while you run?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes you more aware of the litter around you. Look, you're not going to pick up rubbish on every run. You'd be a rubbish runner if you did that every time. But yeah, I think once or twice a week for your recovery run or your slow run, it's definitely a great option. It's also great. Running can, as great as it is, it can be quite a selfish pursuit.
Mm.
So this kind of brings the kind of wholesome doing your bit for society element. And also if your better half's giving you a bit of jip, the amount of times you're going out running, they're not going to argue with you kind of saving the planet,
aren't
they?
That's true, yeah, that's nice. Yeah, nice angle.
What's the most common piece of litter then that you came across when plogging?
I think, yes, not a very exciting one. Probably bottle caps, right. Cigarette butt. You know, I thought people kind of stopped smoking like a long time ago, but apparently not. The amount of cigarette butts was, yeah, quite shocking. But yeah, bottles, bottle caps, cigarettes, plastic bags.
Right. Anything kind of weird or out of the ordinary while you play?
Yeah, a few kind of questionable smelling wet wipes. yeah, which made the rest of the plog not that enjoyable. But other than that, yeah, no kind of bones,
gold watches or
no
anything.
Bones or anything.
Does it make you feel good though? Is there a sense of like I've actually done something for my local community?
Yeah, definitely. So you get the runner's high anyway, obviously, yeah, and yeah. then you get the kind of added element of kind of yeah self-satisfaction for kind of helping out.
Yeah.
I think we should do something.
Agreed. I haven't plogged.
I've never plogged.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Where do you think is the most litter dense area? Parks,
I think maybe, yeah, or like down by the Thames.
Or just get in the river.
Just get in the river, yeah.
Swim run. You have a swim run plog.
Swim run plog. Yeah, that could be good. That could be good. Right. I think it's a great thing that people are doing. And I mean, it's like it's two good things, isn't it? Running's obviously great for you, and cleaning up the environment. So it's a kind of win-win.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Brilliant. Thanks, Isaac.
Thank you. Happy plogging.
Happy plogging.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
When you buy running clothes, what are your top priorities? Something that looks good, makes you feel fast, doesn't break the bank? How about instead something that's good for the planet? Ethical clothing choices are, it seems, an increasing priority for the woke runner. Kerry McCarthy, a vision of wokeness, has joined us in the studio to guide us through the best choices. Kerry, welcome.
Afternoon. I've been rendered speechless by that introduction, but hey, I'll take it.
On to the questions. When we talk about ethical clothing, what do we actually mean?
That's a good question, actually. Funnily enough, we have a feature on ethical running kit coming out in an upcoming issue.
Right.
At the start of 2019. It is a massive coincidence. Hence, I've got a tiny little bit of insight into this.
Yep.
I've been talking to the writers who've been putting it together. And actually, before this process started, I thought that ethical running kit just meant, is it green? Is it good for the planet? And I guess you could probably sum it up by saying ethical running kit means, is it good for the planet?
Yeah.
And how are the people who made it treated?
Yeah. Like,
that's probably the easiest way of putting it.
Yeah.
And within that, I guess you could say it comes down to things like, what are the fabrics and the materials used, what are the coatings and the treatments used on them, the printing and the dyeing, what are the working conditions for the workers? How much are they paid? Yeah. Are the factories clean? How many hours do they have to work? Yeah. Are they working in a safe environment or are they at danger? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think green clothing, you kind of think like, oh, they've made it from a recycled bottle. Like, yeah. Like great. But then you mentioned like dyes, washing, the processes like that that go through treatments, like they the waste in terms of like chemicals.
Yeah, I mean the waste is vast, and actually probably one of the brands that's traditionally not had the best reputation in this area, Nike, was responsible for one of the great innovations, which was producing some of the machines used in the factory, making them run on water rather than oil and parabens. And after they kind of refined these processes, they actually gave it out to the rest of the market.
That's great. There you go.
And just said, you know, we could use this as a competitive advantage, but actually we believe this is best for everyone. So here you go. This is how we did it. Everyone else follow suit.
Oh. Are there any other brands that have kind of made good moves in this area?
Yeah, I think kind of people who are into this kind of thing will know that Patagonia are really the kind of the leader in this area. They take care, they pay a large amount of attention to everything from the working conditions for workers through to the process in the factory, and also how the animals are treated. So, you know, they make quite a lot of down jackets, for example, and merino wool stuff. So the sheep and the geese involved in that, you know, are the geese plucked while they're still, you know, alive and awake, for example? Are they in any pain with this being done? Where are the feathers being plucked from on the body? That kind of that real detail that you don't really think about a lot.
Yep.
But Patagonia have been really across that. Mm. I think Adidas have quite well known now, becoming quite a well known range of shoes called Parley, which is a lot of the time they're just taking existing models but making them with recycled ocean plastics. Brooks, until recently, have quite good creds in this area, and they still do. I think something like 10% of each Brooks shoe is made from recycled parts. Mm. And when you consider that, I read somewhere that each running shoe, doesn't matter the brand, each running shoe has an average of 65 different parts in it.
Right. Wow.
So you can imagine how you could really mess that up environmentally if you just went, we want to do this the best way and we don't care how it's achieved.
Yeah, that's true.
Then there were probably more niche brands like Vord. Sundried, which is a British brand who make their apparel from recycled polyester, recycled coffee grounds, stuff like that. BAM clothing, which I think is just short for bamboo because that's what their clothing is made from, because it's more sustainable and more readily available than cotton. Yeah. Once you start to look into it, if you started off with a mindset of, well, I can't possibly find anything, like you can. You just have to put a bit of effort in.
Is ethical clothing invariably more expensive? Is there a kind of cost associated with buying kind of fair trade when it comes to this sort of stuff?
Depends on the brand. Depends how much they're prepared to suck up the extra costs.
Right.
So one of the big things that more ethically focused brands will do is they will have their apparel made in European factories and the West rather than the East. In our feature coming out, we've listed the 10 countries that are kind of worst at this kind of thing, and they all tend to be out east, as I'm sure people might instinctively have guessed. The cost of doing that means it's going to cost you more.
Yeah.
Portugal is a bit of a hub at the moment for if you want to be seen as ethically sound and also producing good quality clothing. Mm. That's where you'll go to do it currently. There's a cost for you as the producer. Sometimes they'll pass it on to consumers. It tends to be the higher ticket items, such as like technical running jackets, where you'll see the difference. But it's perfectly possible to get things like T-shirts and shorts and socks that are kind of at the same level, really, as what you would be used to paying. So 25 to 40 quid for a T-shirt, similar for shorts, 15 quid for a good pair of technical running socks that aren't going to fill your feet with blisters. So it's fine, really.
Yeah. Are there any sort of telltale signs that clothing has been made unethically? As in if someone picks up like off the rail...
Well, I think, if it's going to say, I'm not going to list all the countries that I alluded to a second ago, but if it says things like made in China, made in Taiwan, there isn't the legislation in those countries that demands that factories adhere to certain standards. Yeah. So it's up to the individual factories to work with the brands that they represent. So it is possible to find pockets where things are done well. Yeah. But generally, if you see one of a number of countries and the made on label, but it's more to do, to be honest, I think, with what's missing from labels.
Right.
So if I can reverse that question and say, how do you know something has been made ethically? It will have one, some, or all of things like a Soil Association logo, which certifies that products have been produced organically, the Fair Wear Foundation, which works with brands within the textile industry to improve working conditions, Fair Trade, I'm sure we all know about, Blue Sign, which is kind of, it's like a system for sustainable textile production, and it eliminates harmful substances, sets standards for environmentally friendly. That's a really big one. Like, brands have to go through an enormous kind of hoop jumping process to prove that they're worthy of this logo, and it's a big deal once they get it. So there were loads of logos you can look for, and obviously you can't possibly remember them, but if you remember one thing, if you see a piece of kit with the Blue Sign logo on it, that's a good thing.
Right, let's go. Great. I did not know that.
No, I didn't know that, yeah. It's quite encouraging to think that actually you don't have to spend like double the money to behave ethically when it comes to buying running clothing. You've touched on this anyway, Kerry, but what are some of the sort of good practices when it comes to making clothing?
I think in terms of fabric use, it's obviously using, like I said, stuff that's more sustainable, so like bamboo, natural fabrics rather than synthetic materials such as polyester, nylon, polypropylene. Those things have good kind of technical qualities. They're cheap, which obviously means that if you're, you know, you're shopping at the kind of the more entry level budget end of the market, you're almost certainly likely to be encountering fabrics that have that. But anything that's natural, merino wool, bamboo, you need to look into how the durable, like the water repellent coatings are put on, because that apparently is, you could really mess it up there. A lot of the brands will produce waterproof jackets that will keep you absolutely dry, but at a high cost to the environment. Stuff like, they're now discovering, they don't have enough of a body of evidence, but actually the silver particles that we see, that we're starting to see in a lot of kit where it helps with the anti-odor, smell, makes you whiff less. A lot of those actually wash out in the washing machine. They get washed into the water system. Fish are absorbing them.
Silver fish. That's what those little things are.
I mean, that could be your superhero name, frankly. Ben Superfish Hobson. Ultimately, what's lacking, I think, is a really quick way where consumers can go, I'm in a rush. I've not got much money.
Yeah.
I vaguely want to do the right thing, but I also can't afford like gazillions of pounds and loads of time. There isn't really kind of a system place where that helps people to do that. So unfortunately, if this is an area you're interested in, you're going to have to look into it a little bit. But the good news is there's so much information out there. If you have opposable thumbs and you can type and you can use Google, you can find out about this. No problem at all.
Have you, as a runner... you get to trial quite a lot of this stuff. Have you noticed a real difference in performance? As in, is it marked? Can you like really go like, oh well, this is ethically made, so it's great that I'm wearing it, but at the same time, it's not very good.
Actually, I wouldn't say that. If I had to, if you said, can you please give us a weakness?
Yeah.
Of ethically sourced kit, I would say that aesthetically, it traditionally has not been great.
Right.
And I think that's a natural consequence of the smaller brands that come along who want to do something. Aesthetics and how cool something looks is probably quite far down on their list. They're also having to discover new ways and processes of doing stuff, so they have to keep it as simple as possible. And a lot of the time, if something looks cool and jazzy, it takes quite a lot of involved work to get there.
Yeah.
But even that's changing, and where we're still at a case where Patagonia are a bit of an outlier in that they are a big company and they really focus on this. But generally, if you're going to buy ethically sound kit, it's going to be smaller brands and brands that people perhaps haven't heard of. Mm. Nike do some stuff, Brooks do some stuff, Adidas do some stuff, but until they fully get on board, people are probably going to have to make a bit of a compromise in the way they look. But in terms of technical properties, no, they're absolutely as good as, you know, kind of more mainstream stuff. Yeah.
Kerry, thanks very much for coming on the podcast talking about
No problem.
Kit. I think it's really interesting, and we look forward to having you on the show sometime in the near future.
Wow.
Pleasure.
What a weird intro and outro.
For more from Runner's World, run on over. I'm joking. Race on over. For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So that brings us to the end of this month's Runner's World podcast. I want to say a big thank you to our guests, Jane Maguire, Keith Foley, Isaac Williams and Kerry McCarthy, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this was recorded.
For more from Runner's World, why not visit our website, runnersworld.co.uk, where you'll find more news, reviews and interviews from the wide world of running.
If you've liked what you heard, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and give us a review. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next month.
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.